Welcome back to the Famous Monsters Podcast, your home to all things horror, sci-fi, fantasy, and that film that made you say, "Don't hide upstairs, stupid!" I'm George, your jack of all trades, and with me is our editor-in-chief, Holly.
Hello.
And Jason the Falcon!
What's up, guys?
Before we get into it, let's hear a message from our sponsor.
In a world shrouded in darkness and filled with monsters, there's only one thing you can do. Become one of them. Do so today by joining the Famous Monsters Fan Club. Show your Monster Kid status with one of our tees, hoodies, or iron-on patches that you can place wherever the hell you want. With a shock monster on your chest, let the ghoulies in the neighborhood know you're part of the team. Get them now at CaptainCompany.com. That's CaptainCompany.com. Now back to the show.
God damn it. Thanks, Kron. You're doing a terrific job. This guy's even better than the last person we had.
I know. We've got really great interns now.
Seriously. You know, well, poor Tommy kind of fell down a pit. But things happen. Yep, that sound means that we're discussing Ricola throat lozenges today. Of course, I kid, we are not. A new grudge film has arrived, and we're going to dive into every follicle of wet hair that is the undying franchise of The Grudge, or Ju-on as we all know it. Now, personally, I remember back in, let's say, I think it was 2002, and I just saw The Ring, the American version. It came out in theaters, and at that time, like, horror, I felt like it was kind of dying for me. Like, it wasn't a lot of good things coming out. And when I saw this film, I was like, all right, creepy horror is starting to be revitalized. Was it perfect? No, but it was still, I felt a spark. And so I was even more excited when I found out that there was, that this was actually a remake of a Japanese film, which was Ringu, which was even more unsettling than the American version ever could be. Stay in that same year now, and I'm looking for more Japanese horror because now I'm hooked. And luckily there was the film Ju-on, which had come out overseas. And I felt like it was like Ringu, but unchained, you know, and because of the movie geek I am, I had to watch the American version and then compare and make notes, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to get something straight here. It's like, obviously anyone who knows I'm a grown ass man. I'm not afraid of anything. You know, I've stood up to biker dudes that are twice my size and not back down from some crazy shit. But I remember there's this one scene, and I usually bring it up anytime someone talks about a horror movie. And this one scene in the series, I believe it may have been part one, too, of The Grudge, where one of the characters, she's running away from the killer ghost, and she makes her way all the way back home. And it's kind of like, when you're a kid, all of us have had that thing where, like, oh, if I run home, like, home is home base. This is where you're safe. You can't touch me when I'm at home. And so there was kind of this mentality. She gets home, and she's like, all right, I'm good. But then, of course, she looks out the peephole. The ghost is out there. She stays and locks that door. She thinks, well, I'm in here. I'm good. Then the phone rings, and then we hear that sound, that sound. And she's like, oh, damn. Like, what's the next step? She bounced to her bedroom, hides under those covers, and there's no super home base than under your covers. We all, growing up as children, like, we had that thing where if I go under my covers, I'm protected from that creak of the closet door opening, that scratch that's happening under the 3 inches between my bed and the floor. Like, these covers are an impenetrable wall. Nothing will hurt me. And then that sheet is pulled from all of us as we see the monster come under the covers and kill her from under. There is no more safety blanket. No, there's super pun intended there. The safety blanket was ripped from us, and I couldn't help but feel like, oh, damn, like, it's bad enough I got Freddy getting me in my dreams. Now I got this mofo coming at me from under the covers. like there was nothing sacred now.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I think that was one of the standout scenes for a lot of people, because it's like, oh, there's no place of safety at all. That's it. It's like being killed by your own teddy bear.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's nothing to save you now.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that Ju-on does so well is that it is the violation of that alone space that you're supposed to have, like whether it be under your covers or in the shower, for example, or, you know, somewhere where you're like, okay, I'm alone, I'm here, I am by myself, I'm safe contemplating, and to have something that violates that is just, it's really terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, indeed. Now, before we get into the movie, in which, warning now to everyone who's listening, there will be spoilers for this new film. So prepare yourself for that. And when we start talking about it, I'll let you know. But right now, I think it's important that, Holly, you're someone who is, I think it's safe to say, an uber fan of the original series.
Yes.
And you've made sure to kind of stay away from the American versions. What about the Japanese series is so special to you? Like, what made it shine so much to you?
Well, I'm not sure if it's that it's incredibly, like, I love the films. I think they're great and terrifying. I'm not sure if it's really what makes them special. It's more that after my experience with Ring and the American remake of Ring, I had actually seen the Japanese Ring first. I was fortunate enough to watch it on a bootleg VHS in my apartment by myself with all the lights off. And it was one of the most horrifying experiences of my life.
Did the phone ring while you were watching it?
It didn't, thank God.
That happened to my aunt the first time she watched it. She was very upset.
But it was a bootleg VHS tape, and I did cover up my television with a blanket afterwards. And then they, you know, then they made the American one. This was in, like, you know, 2000 or so that I watched Ring. And you know, I enjoyed the American version. I thought I appreciated what they did with it. I thought, you know, they obviously they relocated it. They, you know, added some more to the mystery. They enhanced the special effects. They basically went very American, and then they were like, more is more.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which I respected. The original is still my favorite. And about this time, the Ring basically did so well that, you know, Japanese horror suddenly became a thing. And I remember hearing about the remake of Ju-on before I had actually seen Ju-on, which was different than it happened with Ring. And they were, but with this, in this case, they were like, okay, so we're going to take this really effectively scary Japanese film that's awesome, and we're not only going to get the same director to do it, we're going to set the whole thing in Japan just like the original, and we're just going to do it all the same. And it's kind of struck me. I was like, well, okay, so you're basically just saying, yes, we're remaking this because people are too lazy to read subtitles. Like, that is literally the reason you're doing this. So, like, because they're like, oh yeah, no, we're not going to change anything. We're going to have the same setting and the same direct. And it just became so clear to me that was why they were doing it, that I just got sublimely annoyed. And I sought out the original on purpose so I could avoid the American remake. And I was not disappointed in the original at all. I love it. I think it's great. But I continue to avoid American remakes of Asian films. For that reason. Also, I often see the Asian one first and I'm blown away by it. Like when they remade the Pong Brothers film, The Eye. I was like, I am not touching this with a 10-foot pole because the original Eye is one of the greatest movies ever. And to think they could improve on that by putting it in English just because, like, that, I just find that incredibly irritating. And, you know, I mean, it continues to be the same. They continue to remake foreign language films just because people don't like subtitles, and I continue to not see them because I've inevitably seen all the originals. I'm just incredibly grateful that Hollywood has not gotten its slimy paws on rigor mortis, because they would inevitably I don't even want to think about what they would do to that movie.
Well, now you jinxed it.
Oh, God.
I'll knock on wood for you, Holly.
I hope. that's basically it. I'm a bitter old man who is annoyed by the entire concept of remaking something just to make it English. So that's why I've avoided the remakes.
Can I point out something about the Grudge remake specifically, though?
No.
Okay.
You're not allowed to express your opinion. That's not what we're here to do.
It's
this isn't that kind of show.
It's not even my opinion, actually. It's the director's opinion, Takashi Shimizu, which, as you mentioned, he did the original and the remake. And yes. For most remakes, I agree with you. They end up just dumbing it down and sort of it becomes something that it kind of was never intended to. It feels like a weird knockoff. I do want to point out, though, that having Shimizu direct the remake, he specifically said that he was excited to do it because he could go back and sort of fix some mistakes that he wished that he had not made the first time. Mm-hmm. So for the Grudge specifically, I feel like it doesn't quite follow that same pattern that most other J-horror remakes kind of fell into.
That's fair.
Yeah. But only for the Grudge from 2004.
He did take on part two, though. Like, he stayed on for those first two.
Oh, did he do the second one as well?
Yeah. Yeah, he stayed on for one and two.
I haven't seen either, so.
Yeah. What was good about that, like, I'm with you, Jason, on that, and the fact that, like, I liked the American ones because mm-hmm. he was on it. The fact that he got to be on it for part one and two, they kept the mm-hmm. same actors for the ghosts, too, which I thought, well, it was for the lady ghost. I don't think the same kid was there.
Yeah.
Let's grow up.
Yeah.
But that, no, was nice. That was nice. Kyoko
did the same for a long time. Yeah, she really did.
Yeah, it didn't change until like part three, which is honestly, you know what? I forgot there was a part three until I was writing up my notes for this episode.
So did I, actually.
Like, I watched I know I watched it because I rewatched the trailer and I was like, oh, wow, this was really bad. Like, it felt like a straight to DVD movie. It felt like straight to like Cinemax kind of movie or something. Like, it was just made for TV, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And I feel bad knocking for made for TV movies because some are good. But yeah. I'm like, wow, this is really bad, huh? Like, yeah, I know who it had in it. The only notable person in that film was the actress from, she was in The Blob and the Saw movies, Shawnee Smith.
Oh, Shawnee Smith. Yeah.
Yeah, she's the only notable person in that whole film. But besides that, it's like, it's such a throwaway.
Yeah, I mean, when I knock American remakes, it's not to knock the whole franchise beast or anything. I mean, my God, mm-hmm. the Ju-on and Ring franchises are just as milked in Japan as they are anywhere. I mean, I think I think the recent Sadako versus Kayako movie is proof of that. You know, they do it just as badly as we do.
Started out as an April Fool's joke, actually, and then they were like, you know what, why don't we actually make this?
Yeah,
so, like, I still haven't watched it, but I really want to.
I haven't watched it either. I think that's on Shudder, or it was on Shudder, but yeah, I haven't watched it either, but it's not, like, just to clarify, it's not my knocking, like, mm-hmm. sequels or corporate, you know, the corporate mm-hmm. Hollywood machine or anything like that. It's just, it's my general irritation with how lazy people are to just basically, like, oh, I don't want to watch this. Put it in my own language, please.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I totally understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel the same way for, like, the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series.
Yeah.
The original films are already really good. And
the
two American films haven't really done anything that was different or elevated in a way where, like, the originals didn't. You know,
that's
the years, they're so close to each other. It's not like they waited like 10 years between them.
Yeah.
That's how I felt about Let the Right One In. I haven't seen American Let Me In or whatever. Every time I look at it, I'm just like, I don't see how anything could be improved upon. So I'll just take a hard pass on.
And those were even closer together, the release, yeah. I think. Like, mm-hmm. Let the Right One In was, man, that was only a couple of years before they were like, okay, let's do an American version. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, God.
It's honestly practically the same film, just you have Hit Girl in it.
Oh.
That's it. I'll be honest. That's it. Yeah.
She's been in an awful lot of unfortunate horror remakes, hasn't she?
Yeah.
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 Oh,
that's
man.
Not her fault. Gotta make that money. I respect it. It's okay.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not knocking her. Yeah. It's just not a pretty track record.
Yeah, for sure. All right. I think it's important that if for some odd reason no one knows what The Grudge is about, that we give them a little recap of what it happened, how it all started, and how we got to where we're about to get to. Should I leave that? I think out of the two of you, Jason, did you watch it most recently, correct?
Yeah, I rewatched both Ju-on and also The Grudge from 2004 a couple months back. Pretty recently, yeah.
All right, well, lead us off. I think it's important to stick with we'll stick with the American one because the newest one will tie with those.
Yeah, and then, yeah, the American one follows the premise and the story of Ju-on pretty closely. They did give it a little bit more of an overarching sort of like story to hold it together, more so than original Ju-on is almost sort of like an anthology of different encounters with this particular ghost, which is a specific type of ghost called an Onryo, which is basically a vengeful spirit. So to tell the story chronologically, because it almost never is in any of the films, like maybe in some of the later, like The Grudge 2 and stuff, it gets a little bit more straightforward. But having the story told non-chronologically is very distinct for this story in particular. Basically, there's a woman named Kayako and her son Toshio are killed by her husband and his father because she's obsessed with another man and sort of is stalking him and keeping a diary. And so he kills them both in ways that sort of get represented in their ghosts later. And the concept of an Onryo is basically someone that dies in the grips of rage, I think, to quote the thing they always put in the beginning of the movies. And so it very much is a grudge. It's like a curse of hate. Anyone that walks into this house that was theirs gets gripped by the curse, not always right away, but as soon as you walk in, you're pretty much marked for death by the ghost of either Kayako or Toshio is her son, and he meows like a cat. She has her very distinct death rattle that came from when her neck was broken. That's the sound that is so infamous now. So if an American family moves in with, it's like a husband, a wife, and like his elderly mother, and they slowly start getting haunted by these two ghosts that have their various ways of sort of like doing their thing. Then they pass away from the curse. Another American couple has moved in, not to this house, but he's like a student. Her name is Karen. She's played by Sarah Michelle Gellar. She is sort of like a caretaker that is signed up through this program to go basically take care of people who need it, and she gets assigned.
So a similar role to the original character in Ju-on then.
Right.
Who is basically a social worker. Yeah.
Yeah. She's basically a social worker, and the previous one went missing. So they send her to kind of fill in. Again, a lot of this is kind of directly translated, but with an American woman, which kind of gives the nice element of there being this sort of displacement and confusion and she doesn't really speak the language, and it kind of parallels to the wife beforehand. So there's this sort of claustrophobia that comes to these families not living in a culture that they understand, which is something that obviously the original doesn't have, because the original is all Japanese characters. But basically, she gets consumed by the curse as well. So it follows like this family and the sister, and then this other woman and her boyfriend, and the detective that originally worked the case. They all kind of fall into the spiral of this curse that you basically contract like a virus. And it ends with her trying to burn down the house after the detective tries and fails to do it, because he gets got before he can actually do it. And so she thinks that she's ended the curse, and then she goes to identify her boyfriend's body in the hospital, because he succumbs to it too. And then you find out, no, this isn't over. She's still being haunted, and that's pretty much where it ends. So that's an overview of the American remake, essentially.
Yeah, having not seen it, it sounds. I mean, the added we're in a foreign culture angle is always interesting. So yeah. That's a plus. But from what you said, it sounds.
Yeah,
almost exactly as the same as Ju-on.
Right. She just the character of Karen kind of goes and tries to play the detective and sort of piece together like what's happening, like why is this curse, you know, like killing all these people? What happened to this woman? Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit more structured. It's still told non-linearly. There's a lot of parallels. It just has that sort of extra little bit that would make it make a little bit more sense for an American audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's much more what we're used to. So she was a little bit of a minor version of Rachel's character from The Ring, which I also rewatched just the other night.
I haven't rewatched the American one in a long time. I rewatched the Japanese one like every year practically. This is like a ritual, but
yeah, I just watched them back to back. It's a very interesting comparison between those two. Yeah. I actually think I comparing Ringu to The Ring and then Ju-on to The Grudge, I actually think that The Grudge might be a little bit more solid of a remake than The Ring. I mean, I really love The Ring. It's totally silly, but it's still pretty good for what it is. And we definitely wouldn't, like, as you said, like, we definitely wouldn't have the Ju-on remake of The Grudge without The Ring having been so successful. But yeah, I do think of the two, I actually think that The Grudge is a better adaptation.
Plus, I remember, I mean, not to, you know, I know this is a Grudge podcast, but not to go too far off into The Ring, but I remember being annoyed with the American remake specifically because they showed the girl's face. Uh-huh. What did they call her in the American one? Samara? Samara?
Yeah.
And whereas Sadako in the original, it's like, basically you don't know if she's even human and she's got hair in her face the whole time,
right?
And then I went to see the American one, and there's, it's just a, you know, a little girl with like an evil voice, and I'm just like, I don't know if that's quite as terrifying. But
I know Lilo and Stitch's actress, like Lilo from Lilo and Stitch, her voice actress is the girl that played Samara. So it's
really,
it's very
weird. Wow.
Yeah. It's very
random trivia with famous monsters. I had no idea.
I know. I told that to Thurston while we were watching it the other night, and they were like, wait, really? Like, and then when you listen to her talk on the tape, it's totally Lilo. Her voice is not different at all.
Wow. then that's another thing. Sadako doesn't speak either. She just
Yeah.
She just, you know, shuffles around with hair on her face. And to me, that's just infinitely more horrible. But
yeah. I mean, what really sets these two apart is just how, like, really relentless both of these spirits are. I know that's, like, that's their nature as, like, Onryo, like, vengeful spirits, but it really just is so relentless. Like, I think it's kind of poignant, like, the American version has an American girl at the center of it, thinking that she's fixing everything and breaking the curse, and then it's like, no.
Yeah.
Actually not. Like, this is gonna go on forever, because that's the level of hatred and anger that these spirits have.
That's part of what I love so much about these films, actually, and part of what I think makes them scary is that, mm-hmm. you know, you cannot stop it. You are not going to do anything that fixes this. Like, you were just in the way. It's just going to keep going, you know? And to me, there isn't much scarier than basically being told that you don't matter in this. Like, you just, we're just going to swat you out of the way and keep going. Like, you know, you're just another casualty.
Right.
Well, I think that gets everyone nice and updated.
Mm-hmm.
Are we ready to get into the?
Oh, I can't wait to hear this.
Yeah, I'm trying to stay upbeat and positive here. So this is spoiler moment. We're about to, like, explain everything that happens in the New Grudge. First and foremost, it kind of got promoted as if it was going to be a remake or a redo, but it really kind of felt like it was just a reboot / continuation of what we've seen of the past 2 to 3. I was even say 2, because I don't think they really even touched upon the things that could have or would have happened in 3. It really focused on 1 and 2, because those were the good ones.
Right.
So this movie flashbacks to the times of 2004 and 2006, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And the things that are happening are actually coinciding as the same time as the things that would have been happening in part 1 and part 2.
That's interesting.
So it's kind of like, wow. On paper, it sounds interesting. But it doesn't work out that way, unfortunately.
No.
I will say for me, so my experience with this film, personally, I felt like it kind of got summed up right from the beginning, where not even less than 5 minutes, we'll say within 3 minutes of the film starting, we get our first jump scare. And it wasn't even like a good jump scare. We have this lady who seems like she's also a caretaker, possibly of some sorts, leaving the house that we've seen in the original films.
Right.
And she's petrified. She's seen some shit. And so she's out. She's done with it. But you see she's outside the house, scared and looking around like something's about to happen. And all we see is this pile of trash bags in front of the home, in front of like the wall. And of course, there's one of them looks like it's breathing, which that was a cool effect.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one that's next to her grabs her.
But what did breathing trash bags have to do with? I'll just keep quiet and let you.
Holly, you've got good questions.
What does a breathing trash bag have to do with a vengeful spirit? Why a breathing trash bag?
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, but that's our first scare. Like, I don't mind a jump scare personally. Jump scares are fine. They have a purpose, and they're welcoming for me, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you have to build up to it. You can't just open up the movie during the daytime and just be like, "Huh!" You know, it's like, okay, really? This, like, you're not even going to try, then, are you? And that's what I got. I got from the rest of the movie. It's like, we are not even going to try. This film for me honestly felt like, all right, guys, we got the license of the Grudge, right? It's about to expire in about a few weeks. We got to bust out a film. Just hire someone who's at least done a film and have them write something. And then let's just get it going. Let's get it going. All right. Get some actors that people may have seen at some time in their life. All right. And then pop them in there.
Keep get the two license names that fresh.
People really like. Yeah. But that's what it felt like. You know, it's like, Holly, me and you often reminisce on how much we love the Hellraiser franchise.
Oh, yes.
But we also, I'm pretty sure, are equal in the fact that we are not happy with where it went, because it got to a point where it's like, all right, this is a license that has to just be renewed every so often.
Eventually, so yes. Film. I was entertained, you know? And I was entertained until about the fourth film, and then afterwards it got kind of annoying. Yeah.
So. Yeah. And that's, I think that's where they're at, honestly, with this film. Because even like when part three was made, that felt like it was just put together just for the sake of putting it together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, but I think some of the, for me, some of the biggest things that was wrong about this, and I feel bad hating on a movie so hard, because here we love movies. This is what we do for a living. We celebrate film every day within our jobs, you know, and this is a series that all of us loved so much within different ways, whether it was the original or the remakes. There's parts of it that have been within our lives that we just always go look back to. It's like, well, I got to watch that again because of this thing, or you know, something about it just lingered in our minds. And this was, it felt disrespectful, honestly, like whoever wrote this, it was just like, yeah. I don't know. Like, let's just get some things together. And the first one kind of jumped around from timelines and different things. Let's do that. Let's jump around and do things. But like the jumping around made no sense. Like, it wasn't concise in any kind of way. And characters, yeah, like no one knew what they were supposed to be doing as a character. So to give an example, we have our main character, Detective Muldoon, who was played by, I don't remember her name, Tara, not was it Tara? No. It was Andrea Riseborough. She plays Detective Muldoon. Now, she doesn't do necessarily a bad job of acting, but there was this sense of like, either she didn't know what a detective did, or the director didn't know how detectives were supposed to act. Like, they didn't know what a law official would do. And so yeah, there's a few scenes like this. The first scene we get, I guess that sticks out for me, is she's washing her face. And so she fills up her bathroom sink with water, and she starts splashing her face. Now, she's already been inside the house, of course, so the ghost is after her. It pushes her head in and starts to try to drown her. She then gets out of this, and she's scared, of course, and she's looking around. Now, I'm just a normal person. I'm not even a cop. As a normal person, I'm going to look through my house and find out who the hell pushed my head in the water. Because it's only me, my little, like probably, I don't know, 6-year-old son, and a dog. So no one could have done that to me. I'm going to look around. She doesn't look around. She just like takes a look back and forth, breathes, and then goes on her merry way. Like nothing happened.
Yeah, she like laid on the floor for a second. And then it was like, well, I must have imagined it or something like that. Except she doesn't even say anything to give you kind of any indication of why she might not have looked around. She just didn't do it.
Yeah.
And the, like the her facial expressions
tell us that.
Like that. Right.
Yeah. And like, and so that could have been a one-off scene, right? Maybe that was a fluke. No, it was not. We get another scene later on where she's in the precinct. At this point, she's starting to get the crazies because the ghost has been lingering quite a bit in her world. And she's like, what's going on? And she's actually doing some research on the old partner that the guy she's working with, which is Detective Goodman, I believe. And his partner went crazy because he went inside the house and he started seeing the ghost. So she's trying to figure out what happened. What did he see? And she's going through old tapes and stuff. And there she goes to the bathroom and she hears a noise. She leaves the bathroom. She feels like someone was following her. So she looks at the camera and she sees someone came out of the bathroom. It was this big dude. She's like, all right, there's someone in here with me. The lights go out. Shit goes down. And she sees a ghost, of course. But as she's traversing through these hallways and going around in the darkness, the way she holds her gun and the flashlight. Again, yeah. I'm not a cop. I've actually never even fired a gun in my whole life. But I've seen how you're supposed to hold one. I have friends who are cops. And I've seen how you're supposed to do it. There's a way you hold it. She's like got her gun like tucked near her rib cage. And the flashlight is pivoted up near her head. So they're nowhere near each other. There's no stability here to hold this gun. Which we will also note is just a revolver. It's that kind of felt out of place. I think we talked about it after we saw this movie in the theater.
Yeah.
But so everything about this moment just feels odd. And it's like, let's say if she were to shoot, I'm pretty sure that, first of all, you're not going to shoot properly if you shoot from the rib cage. And I'm pretty sure you're going to hurt yourself. Any gun has kickback.
Well, you gotta use. I mean, you gotta use two hands almost always.
Right.
I mean, that seems like common sense.
Absolutely no sense. It was literally like she was about to shoot from the armpit, like not even shoot from the hip. She was shooting from her armpit, and I feel like that's where she held her gun all the time. And
I think you're right. Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, it was very, very bizarre.
I will keep my gun safe in my warm armpit.
Right. But yeah, like, why did she have a revolver? Like, the whole, like, everything about the set and the prop work was so confusing because they were, again, this is, her time was set in 2006. It was doing some flashbacks to 2004 and then sometime kind of in the middle. She was set in 2006 and they're in some random small town. So it's like, yeah, you're not going to have a lot of super fancy, nice stuff, but everything in it, like the cars and the TVs and everything, seemed like it was from the 70s and 80s. Like they were even smoking in the diner that was weirdly carpeted everywhere.
You can't smoke in diners. You haven't been able to.
It was very bizarre. It really felt like they had started to shoot a movie that was a period piece set in the late 70s or early 80s and then changed it to The Grudge from 2006 halfway through. It was super, super confusing. Like,
they overestimated their period piece there. It's like, this was 15 years ago. That must have been back when you could smoke in diners.
Right. It was like the whole set and prop department was run by a 15-year-old that doesn't know what 2006 was like. Like, if they're trying to make it feel like a small town that doesn't have a lot of money, the movie was only 93 minutes long. You have time to do some establishing, like, setup shots, but there were none in the whole thing. There were no establishing shots whatsoever. So everything felt really kind of foggy and out of place, and you never quite knew what was happening. It was very weird. Very, very weird.
Yeah. Yeah, like, to add to that, like, especially like props. All the props were dated. Like, just to give you exactly why we thought it was probably the 80s or 70s, every single TV that we saw had clickers on it. You know, the little clicker thing that you turn, the knobs?
Every TV
pretty much had that. Even in 2006, we already had flat screen TVs.
Yeah, there was no such thing as a channel clicker in 2006.
Yeah.
I remember, I lived through that shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were like the TVs with the wood cases. Like, I was surprised they didn't have antennas coming out of them. And then everyone was driving like weird old cars.
Station wagons.
Yeah, it was really just the most bizarre thing.
Weird.
Like, I think there were a couple cars in the background of one or two scenes that were from like the mid-90s, but it just made it feel more confusing.
Yeah, like, so for instance, like, the realtor was played by John Cho. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love John Cho. Oh, he got saddled with this film. Oh, that makes me sad.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, John Cho and I think Betty Gilpin play Peter and Nina Spencer. They're about to have a kid. They are a husband and wife duo who are realtors. Now, I don't know about you, when I think of realtor, I think of someone who possibly could have money. And even if they're not really doing that well at being a realtor, they're still going to put on her front as if they're really good at it. So they'll have a nice car. They have like an old wood panel station wagon.
Yeah.
We had one of those in Brady like 1989.
Yeah.
It was beige. It was beige and wood paneled.
Oh my God.
It's like, this is out of place. Like, why would you have that car? That doesn't make any sense.
Oh, that makes me sad that John Cho had to be in this. Oh, well.
Yeah.
And that's the weird thing is, like, none of the actors I felt like did a bad job. They were just given the most incomprehensible thing to work with, which kind of made it worse. Like, there were parts of this that I thought were good, and the movie itself was so bad, like the structure and editing of it was so bad, that the good parts made the whole movie worse. Like, there were parts where I enjoy when a horror film makes an attempt at subtlety. There's times where you see ghosts in the background and no attention is drawn to them. Like, you have to be looking specifically at that part of the screen, but the camera work is drawing your eye somewhere else. So it's really subtle, and that kind of stuff is cool. Like, there were a few different parts where that's what was happening. But then everything else about it was just so bad. All of the character actions, like, I couldn't tell why anyone was doing any of the things that they were doing. Like, at the very end, the main detective, who, again, was very bad at being a cop, she tries to go burn down the house because that's the only way.
Oh, we're going to this part. Thinks. Okay.
Yeah. We'll just skip right to the end real quick. She tries to burn down the house, but she has, for one, it's a pretty big house. She has like one small can of gasoline. And what she does, instead of pouring it through the house and then backing up so that you're at the door when you're going to throw the lighter or match.
Right, she as walks one does.
In and immediately starts pouring it in front of her and then walks through the house that way. Everything about it was weird.
What did she do? Did she jump out the window or?
Well, no, because then she encountered some weird ghost activity, which Kayako and Toshio were not in this. Kayako might have been in it for like a second, but it was the family that originally died, which was the social worker that came back from Japan that infected everybody else. They were the main ghosts, which doesn't follow with the rest of the series, even though they put that first scene in there of her walking out of the house. So you think it's supposed to be in the same continuity, and then it doesn't follow any of its own rules, even though they specifically set it up to be a part of it. So she sees the wife kill the husband and kid for reasons, ? And well, then
at this point she goes, because when she sees her, the ghost is like, I want to show you something.
Yeah.
And she keeps on doing it. It's like, I want to show you something. And so she follows her to like this area. And in that area, she sees like, oh, this is where I killed my husband. It's like, oh God, throw some gasoline here then. And she brings her to the next area. I killed my daughter in this bathroom. Oh, more gasoline in this room then. Okay.
Yeah. The never ending gasoline can. And then she brought her son with her for no reason, just to tell him to sit in the car and not leave. And then she sees him inside the house and she's like, what? But then it's not really him. And they have this weird thing about, what do we do when we're scared? We close our eyes and count to five, that they do like six times through the whole movie. And it's very annoying and stupid.
And wasted. They wasted that. Yeah, that could have been something really good.
Yeah, it was totally wasted. Nothing happened. And then she's like, oh, wait, this isn't really my son. And so she sets the house on fire and leaves and then goes back to her own house. And then the next morning, she gives her son a hug, like while the bus is outside waiting and definitely wouldn't wait for him as long as it did. Then she realizes, oh, this ghost isn't really my son, because then in the background, her kid is like, bye, Mom, I'm going to school, and then grabs his backpack and leaves.
I'm already confused.
It was confusing, because there's no reason for any of this, which is why. Like, and then it just shows the house for like a silent minute, which was the weirdest experience in a theater in my life, because it's just a shot of the exterior of the house. It's broad daylight. Nothing's happening. And then the credits start rolling. There's no music for like a solid 60 seconds. So yeah. All you can hear is people standing up and quietly shuffling out while it's just this shot of the house as credits are going over it. And then it cuts to black and then the credits roll again and then the music starts. So I'm sitting there dying laughing because of how weird and surreal everything is. And then it's just people leaving the theater is all you can hear. It was kind of hilarious, but it was, the whole thing was horrible.
Wow.
Yeah. In which I want to backtrack a little bit because some stuff happens before she goes to burn the house, which adds to things that bothered me so much. So before she decides to even burn the house, she's been doing a lot of investigating. So she's really losing it at this point. With the good reason, I will say. Her emotions of how crazy things get are reasonable. I would have lost my mind too. But yeah. We get to a point where she's outside. She's picked up smoking again. Something we hear that she used to do when she dropped, but now she's smoking. Because who wouldn't after seeing ghosts?
Yeah.
Right.
And within this, she ends up seeing... she hears something. She hears something inside go down. And so she tries to go in and figure out what the hell's happening. But then all of a sudden on the outside, we get to see one of the, I think it's the husband mm-hmm. ghost who is killed earlier on. He's coming after her. So she runs away from him, gets inside the home, closes the door, but he's pushing against her. So she's struggling trying to keep this door closed. And then he pretty much like pushes the door so hard she falls down on her butt. Now, she had a gun in her hand. I should mention that. There was a gun in her hand. She falls down. Gun falls out of her hand. She's lying there for a hot second. Does nothing. At all. Keep in mind, she has a son and a dog in this house that she should be protecting. I would have reached for the gun, looked around. Like, she just, like, because no one barged through the door right afterwards, she's just like, okay, I guess I'm safe. I'm not going to go and check anything out. I'm not going to reach for my gun and try to shoot anybody. We're good. A few seconds passes. She calls up her partner, Detective Goodman. He comes over and she explains everything. He's someone who's been aware of this whole shit. And he doesn't want to believe ghosts are real. But at the same time, he's never gone inside the house. He's like, I'm not going to mess with that at all. And so she talks to him and she explains, like, I'm going crazy. All this stuff's happening. Now, logically, you'd think, because this is right before she goes to burn the house, maybe she should leave her son with him because he's not going to go to the house and he hasn't been tainted by the ghost. She doesn't do that. She takes her son. She drives down the strip and he's like, where are we going, Mom? I'm taking you somewhere safe. And then she proceeds to park in front of the house that she's about to burn.
Right.
As we've established, if you go inside the house and if you're touched by this house, you die. It's like, right. Why would you do this? And she's like, just stay in the car. She's like, all right?
Don't get out of the car.
In which, when another she does thing- get out of the house and it's burning, he's already out of the car. Like, we don't see him get out of the car. He's already out of the car and he's running towards his mom.
Right.
So it's like, whoa, dude, you didn't listen to your mom? What did she say?
Right. One of the weirdest things about that part to me was not only does she call the detective to come over and explain everything that just happened to him, he doesn't say anything. He just has like a pensive look on his face. And then it cuts to her attempting to commit the worst arson attempt I've ever seen. But we never see him again. He doesn't get brought up and we don't ever see him again. So did he tell her to burn the house down and we're just going to cover for her? Like, what? It was just really weird.
Yeah, because when a house burns down, cops, fire trucks come. There's reports done.
Right.
There was neighbors in that neighborhood who watched everything. They were snoopy as hell. Someone That's saw true. Her burn that house. Are you telling me she just got away with it?
Right. She's like the only waifish towhead blonde in this town. Like, there's no one to mistake her for. Like,
and she's new to the town too.
Right. Very new.
So everyone knows that she's new. Like, anyone sees her is like, oh, you're not one of us. You know?
Right. It was completely incomprehensible. Another thing that really irritated me, like, because there were parts that seemed like they were kind of referencing the original movies, like burning down the house, and there was a big staircase, and there was the part with the security camera, and it was like they specifically referenced kind of iconic moments from the originals and then did nothing with it. So it was like it specifically put the picture in your mind of like the sister from the 2004 version watching Kayako approach as this fuzzy black shadow on the security camera and then come up to the camera and like scare the hell out of her. It was like they specifically wanted you to remember that from the part where she was looking at the security camera in the precinct.
Yeah.
But then all you see is like a man coming out of the bathroom who wasn't actually there. It like no payoff whatsoever. It was like, hey, remember this? We're not going to do that.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was, yeah, the whole thing was really bleak too. Like no one was having a good time for literally any part of it. There was actually a review on Bloody Disgusting by William Bibbiani, and I'm quoting him because he pretty much summed it up, and I can't think of a better way to put this. He wrote, "The new film is a downer from minute one and never changes moods. It's as though each character's life is predetermined to be dreary, and adding ghosts to the mix is merely beating a dead horse." Because the reason this woman has moved to this town with her kid is her husband just died of cancer, and then her new detective partner just proceeds to smoke during the whole thing, and then talks about his mom dying, and then she's like, yeah, my husband died of cancer, and he's like, wow, I can't even imagine, and then takes a drag on a cigarette. And then she starts,
you don't mind if I smoke, do you?
Right. It's like, oh, no, go ahead. For sure.
Yeah, no empathy. Really, no empathy whatsoever.
No, it was so weird. It was so weird.
No, that's a good point. Almost every single character that gets to talk, something is wrong with them. Because John Cho and his wife, their characters, their kid is going to have, what was it, like Down syndrome or something? Like their kid was going to be born with some kind of deficiency.
Yeah.
And so the two of them are trying to deal with that and like cope with it. And you get this sense where like they're even questioning, like, should they go through with having the kid or whatnot?
Right.
And there's this struggle and there's just a lot of sadness between the two of them. And then when we see, we haven't talked about yet, is freaking this lady's character, Lin Shaye.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh like, my God. My brain temporarily blocked that whole part out.
Yeah. That was actually one of the cool looking parts. But
well, Lin Shaye is like hilarious. I mean, she's great.
She's great. She, her character's dealing with was it dementia or Alzheimer's? Like she's,
of course,
starting
there
to,
has
like,
to be something. There has to be some disease.
Yeah.
You can't just have a healthy character.
No.
So it's like, so her and her husband are dealing with that. It's like every person, there's something. There's something wrong with them. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point. There is no happiness in this whole film.
Wow.
No one was having a good time ever. The kid, it seemed like whoever wrote this has never spoken to a child before. Because it's like, I get that it's hard to write parts for kids that they can act out. Literally, it was like a 6 or 7 year old kid going like, "What's wrong, mommy? I'm scared." Like, that is pretty much what he sounded like through the whole thing.
Yeah. Just, yeah.
Oh, it was, there's a lot of things that were wrong with this movie. It didn't feel like a remake. It felt like a knockoff, like a bootleg. Not even the bootleg VHS that you watched, Holly, probably was better than this. But it really felt like some weird approximation of like someone kind of thought about The Grudge or like read a synopsis on Wikipedia and was like, yeah, I can write a movie that is that, and then wrote this.
Okay, well, more of the story, folks. Don't remake something too many times.
Or wow. At least watch the thing that you're trying to remake first. Yeah, not not a lot of positivity out of this one.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I didn't watch it.
Mm-hmm. Now we got you covered.
Yeah, I'm not sad that I missed this one. I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah. Nor should you be. Just rewatch the 2004. Watch the 2004 one, and you might have a good time with that. Or just rewatch Ju-on itself, and don't. This was 93 minutes long, and it felt like about 4 hours.
What did Thurston say when we watched it? I thought you said this wasn't 4 hours. Something like that.
Right. Right. I thought you said it was only 93 minutes long. Because that's the thing is, like, they were trying to do the non-linear thing, but there was no rhyme or reason to what was coming after what.
Oh, sorry.
So it didn't feel... It didn't feel interesting.
Bucky.
It felt like treachery.
Bucky, shush.
In case you listeners don't know, each of us is at our homes right now, and Holly
my
has a dog.
My dog is barking. I apologize for that.
He's a very cute dog, but
he is very cute, but he doesn't know when to shut up.
But he has a lot to say.
Yeah, clearly. Mm-hmm. I guess
he didn't like it either.
He went to see The Grudge too, and he's like, "This is how I felt about it."
The Grudge, not Bucky approved.
Not Bucky approved.
At the top of my note sheet, I actually wrote F for F that.
I saw that you posted about online, and your notes were hilarious. By the way, the photos of your notes,
I could tell
everything
on.
You were going to say just looking in the notes. Like, oh my god, this is going to be bad.
Yeah, and so you know that there's stuff that I didn't even touch on that I hated. Like, I could go on about how everything wrong with this movie for twice as long as the movie actually was. Like, this is one of those times where it's like, it seems like someone in the editing room was like, I have to save everybody from this movie, so I need to make it as short as possible. But it really could have benefited from an extra 5 minutes of like context and establishment and just something more
something
than
something just something
dribble. Yeah, do something to it.
I'd go as far to say maybe Sam Raimi should just actually direct the film instead of just producing it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's heartbreaking that his name is attached to this.
Yeah. Cause the thing, every time you see a commercial for it, it's like from producer Sam Raimi. It's like, no, don't do that to him. Don't know.
Right.
He's done some good stuff.
Yeah.
And it was like,
and even when he produces, even some of the stuff he's produced have been good. Like, did you guys see the Crawl, the alligator film?
I have not seen it yet.
I didn't get to watch
that movie
yet.
Was fun as hell. And that had his name all over it. And it was, I had a lot of fun with that movie. But
see, the weird thing is there were parts in this that were genuinely kind of funny, which I'm like, maybe he was like, you have to let me put 4 jokes in here or something like that. But it's like nothing.
Please let me be funny, please.
Right. Right. It really just seemed, it really seems like something happened midway through production where it was supposed to be something and then they had to change it last minute. Because it really feels like they were trying to make a different movie and then something went very wrong. I mean, I know they had some reshoots, but something bad happened here.
Extended
the one
fart
thing
noise.
I do have to say that I appreciate that this movie did was they turned grudged into a verb. And I do appreciate that. That's hilarious, and I probably will be using that. Like, oh, that house has been grudged. Oh, you got grudged. Like,
oh, that's interesting.
That's kind of the only good thing to come out of this.
Yeah, I like that. I approve of playing with language. That's fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that came from. We didn't even touch on the everything that happened with the former detective partner. Too much to get into, but it
William Sadler's character. But that was a waste. Like, William Sadler's a decent actor.
Yeah.
I like him. Like, I always think of like Demon Knight and Bill and Ted. Like, this is someone I've seen within my childhood that I've always liked in films. And he was just like pushed aside to a character that could have been really interesting, but
yeah,
it was whatever.
It was very bad.
Yeah. They also, I will note, before we wrap this up, because you brought up his character, mm-hmm. he was the detective, he was a partner to Detective Goodman, he was Detective Wilson. He mm-hmm. tries to kill himself because of how much he's lost his mind thanks to this house, uh-huh. and he does not succeed, he lives, and they put him in a psych ward. Now, I'm pretty sure we all know, if you get put into a psych ward, you pretty much don't get to be whatever you were anymore. You're not a doctor, you're not a cop, you're nothing. You're now committed to this place because you're never going to be a cop again. Right? You tried to kill yourself.
Right.
When Detective Muldoon's character comes in and is looking for him, I'm here to see Detective Wilson. It's like, no, he's not Detective Wilson anymore. He's just John. Right. You're here to see John. All right.
And then he starts freaking out because he's like, oh, you've been grudge. So he starts pulling at his restraints and losing his mind. And what does she do? She wordlessly just walks out. She's just like, oh, shit. And then just bounces.
Yeah, like, this is a guy who's obviously crazy. No one's watching him.
Right. He's like, let's rip our eyes out so we can't see the ghost.
We don't know
anymore.
A guard.
And she's like,
never heard
that
of him.
That probably is fine. And then walks away. Absolutely incomprehensible is the only way I can sum this up.
Okay. But you know what? Don't take our word for it. Watch it yourself and let us know what you think.
You know what? I don't think I'm going to, after hearing this, I don't think
I don't
I'm
think
gonna subject
going
myself
to
that.
Either.
Yeah.
I will say I did see some people in some parts of the internet say that they enjoyed it. So maybe you'll find something good out of it and you can come
or
tell
maybe
us
their
why
standards
we're
are
wrong.
Just really low.
Yeah.
It could be.
Actually, you know what? Anyone who listens to this, if you watch The Grudge, the new film, and there's something you liked, please let us know. Hit us up on our social media and let us know what you liked about this movie.
Yeah.
Because maybe it might shine a new light for us to see what we could have liked.
Maybe.
Well, that's all the time we have for tonight. Thanks for joining us on this journey through our, maybe it's not one of our favorite horror films, but it's definitely one of our favorite genres. We love horror.
Yeah. It made us think about some of our favorites.
And go and watch the original. Go and watch Ju-on and its sequels. And
Yeah, if you haven't watched the original series, do yourself a favor. Watch that. Yeah. You're going to love it. And you'll be thanking us for it.
Yeah,
it's good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And while you're at it, if you haven't subscribe now to Famous Monsters Podcast. You can hit us up on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast. And of course, we're still on Audioboom and anywhere else you listen to your podcast. Holly, where can they follow us?
You can follow Famous Monsters on social media. On Twitter, we're at Famous Monsters. On Instagram, we are also at Famous Monsters. On Facebook, we are under Famous Monsters of Filmland / FMOFL because some little turd already had Famous Monsters. At least
damn,
that's the
someone sour.
At least that's the explanation that I've been given. Just search Famous Monsters. We'll pop up.
And please let us know whatever topics or films you want us to cover next, and we will definitely go through it and hit it up. Who knows? Your suggestion could be our next episode, and you'll get a shout out. Till next time. sorry, hairball.
That was brilliant.